I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Welcome to 2006, friends of Change Surfer Radio. We've been on the air on Change Surfer since the fall of 1998, and it's been a wonderful ride. And we're making a slight change this year because the Change Surfer Radio program has been adopted by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. It's a little bit incestuous because I'm also the executive director and founder of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, but we're going to be kind of institutionalizing what's been happening over the last couple of years with Change Surfer as the movement of techno-progressive thought and activism began to coalesce around the ideas that I had been talking about for a while with this radio program. The program will now be focused increasingly on the policy agenda and the activist agenda of techno-progressive ideas and techno-liberation. So we'll be talking increasingly about what that's all about. One of the upshots of our focus on the agenda of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies is that I'm going to be talking a lot about human rights this spring because we're organizing the first conference of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. That conference is going to happen on May 26th to May 28th, 2006 at Stanford University Law School, Stanford, California. And it's co-sponsored by the Center for Cognitive Liberty and Ethics and the Stanford Center for Law and the Biosciences and the Stanford Program in Ethics and Society. And we're having many, many speakers. The focus of the conference is human enhancement technologies and human rights. Now, for those of you who are new to the program, what is a human enhancement technology? It's something that makes you smarter, makes you live longer, something that makes you happier than human beings have ordinarily been able to accomplish with the simple technologies that they've had at their disposal. But actually, we kind of problematize that by pointing out that there's a lot of continuity with what people have been doing for thousands of years or trying to do for thousands of years and what we hope to be able to do in the near future with nanotechnology and genetic engineering and psychopharmaceuticals and so forth. But at any rate, there is a lot of concern out there about the effect on a variety of different kinds of human rights of the emergence of these new human enhancement technologies. And our techno-progressive perspective is that, in fact, it is the right to have universal access to safe human enhancement technologies, which is one of the best guarantees of human rights, our ability to exercise our human rights. So some of the speakers who are going to be at already that we know, there's going to be many, many dozens of speakers at this conference, but some of the speakers that we know who will be there already, Rai Sententia, the director of the Center for Cognitive Liberty and Ethics, Hank Greeley, who's a bioethicist from the Stanford Program of Law, Science, and Technology, Chris Peterson, who's the vice president of the Foresight Institute, a nanotech think tank, Anita Silvers, one of the leading thinkers in disability rights, Julian Savulescu from Oxford University, one of the leading bioethicists. So if you're interested in this conference and the kind of motivating ideas around it, take a look at ieet.org/HEHR, and that's the Human Enhancement and Human Rights Conference. And I'll just read you a little bit of the motivating language here. Much of the criticism of enhancement technologies has focused on the potential for increased discrimination against women, people of color, the poor, the differently abled, or unenhanced humans. Some bioethicists have proposed a global treaty to ban enhancement technologies as crimes against humanity. Defenders of enhancement argue that the use of biotechnologies is a fundamental human right, inseparable from the defense of bodily autonomy, reproductive freedom, free expression, and cognitive liberty. While acknowledging real risks from genetic, prosthetic, and cognitive enhancement, defenders of enhancement believe that the bans on the consensual use of new technologies would be an even greater threat to human rights. Healthcare, disability, and reproductive rights advocates have argued that access to technology empowers full and equal participation in society. On the same grounds, a generalized right to technological empowerment might connect defenders of enhancement technologies with disability activists, reproductive rights activists, with would-be parents seeking fertility treatments, the transgendered with aesthetic body modifiers, drug policy reformers, and anti-aging researchers with advocates for dignity in dying. Yet, what, if any, limits should be considered to human enhancement? On what grounds can citizens be prevented from modifying their own genes or brains? How far should reproductive rights be extended? Might enhancement reduce the diversity of humanity in the name of optimal health? Or, conversely, might enhancements inspire such an unprecedented diversity of human beings that they strain the limits of liberal tolerance and social solidarity? Can we exercise full freedom of thought if we can't exercise control over our own brains using safe, available technologies? Can we ensure that enhancement technologies are safe and equitably distributed when our regulatory efforts simply covert illiberal value judgments? Between the ideological extremes of absolute prohibition and total laissez-faire that dominate public discussions of human enhancement, there are many competing agendas, hopes, and fears. How can the language of human rights guide us in framing the critical issues? How will enhancement technologies transform the demands we make of human rights? With the Human Enhancement and Human Rights Conference, we seek to begin a conversation with the human rights community, bioethicists, legal scholars, and political activists about the relationship of enhancement technologies to human rights, cognitive liberty, and bodily autonomy. It is time to begin the defense of human rights in the era of human enhancement. Okay, so that's the call to arms of the Conference on Human Enhancement Technologies and Human Rights, which will happen at Stanford University Law School, May 26th to 28th, 2006. You can find out more or register for the conference at ieet.org/HEHR. And now for some little wacky news. There was a piece that came out, I guess the original documents were released or written about in The Scotsman, and then this was picked up and talked about by other scholars who knew about this case around the world. But at any rate, this is one of the better articles that came out about this issue of Stalin's chimp army breeding project. This is a bit of what was written in the New York Times about this by Clive D. Wynn, who's a psychologist who's worked on ape genetics. What is it about watching young women being ravished by oversized, middle-aged gorillas that presses so many buttons and fuels so many King Kong movies, including the latest version opening on Wednesday? Cynthia Erb, in Tracking King Kong, suggests a few of the factors behind the success of the first King Kong movie in 1933: racist fear of miscegenation, Depression-era desire for the exotic, and sexist lust to see a woman taken against her will. But 70 years of academic study have overlooked one crucial bit of history, a human and ape sexual drama widely reported in North American newspapers in the mid-1920s that, though now forgotten, must surely have informed the first King Kong movie creators. In the mid-1920s, the culture wars were dominated, as they are today with intelligent design, by the debate between creationism and evolutionary thinking. In 1925, John T. Scopes had been found guilty of teaching that mankind arose from something other than divine creation. But the United States was not the only country passionate about the issue. The young Soviet Union, in its effort to stamp out religion, was determined to prove that men were descended from apes. In 1926, a Soviet scientist named Ilya Ivanov decided that the most compelling way to do this would be to breed a human-chimpanzee hybrid. Ivanov set off for a French research station in West Africa. There he inseminated three female chimpanzees with human sperm. Not his own, for he shared the colonial-era belief that the local people were more closely related to apes than he was. He stayed long enough to learn that his experiment had failed. Next, Ivanov wrote a Cuban heiress, Rosalia Abreu. Abreu was the first person to breed chimps in captivity and had a large menagerie outside Havana. Ivanov asked if any of her male chimpanzees might be available to inseminate a Russian volunteer known to posterity only as G. At first, Abreu was agreeable, but Ivanov made the mistake of approaching Charles Smith of the American Association for the Advancement of Atheism for fundraising support, and Smith was something of a showman. He liked to appear in public with a chimpanzee dressed in a business suit and went to the newspapers with Ivanov's proposal. The New York Times thundered, "Soviet backs plan to test evolution." The resulting publicity brought the case to the attention of the Ku Klux Klan, which threatened Abreu with retaliation if she took part in Ivanov's experiment, calling it abominable to the creator. Abreu withdrew her consent. Before Ivanov could find another chimpanzee breeder, he fell out of favor in one of Stalin's purges and was exiled to Kazakhstan in 1931. He died a year later. So anyway, if you do a Google on Ivanov and Stalin and chimpanzee, you'll find a lot of the articles about this. There are articles in the UK Sun and the Scotsman and Australian newspapers and so forth, all about the brief and abortive efforts of Stalin to breed a chimp army. Let me just point out parenthetically that Anne Ravelingen, a Belgian bioethicist who's an intern for the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and I are working on a paper about the ethics of humanities and chimp uplift, as I like to call it, which is, I don't recommend breeding projects such as Stalin was attempting here, but I do argue in Citizen Cyborg that human beings have an obligation, once we have cognitive enhancement technologies and technologies to facilitate communication with chimpanzees, that we have an obligation to provide those to great apes in order to allow them more decision-making and autonomy over their lives. So I think this issue will come to the fore more in the future. And of course, humanities probably will be created at some point in the future. Another one of the policy concerns of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies is how to ensure universal access to advanced and emerging medical technologies, which allow for life extension and cognitive enhancement and all the other kinds of goals that we are looking towards. And the concern, of course, is that these technologies will be too expensive for people in the developing world and some people in the developed world, and that they may be unsafe and that they may drive out access to other technologies, which would actually improve people's lives more. One of the arguments that we are fond of making, and I think there is a strong case for, is that some of the technologies that are imagined, some of the enhancement technologies that are imagined, would actually take care of problems which otherwise would be only ameliorated by more Band-Aid type solutions. So at any rate, that I think is a context for this piece that comes out of the WHO, the World Health Organization. Each year, 100 million people slide into poverty as a result of medical care payments. Another 150 million people are forced to spend nearly half their incomes on medical expenses. That's because in many countries, people have no access to social health protection, affordable health insurance, or government-funded health services. Paradoxically, people in the world's poorest countries contribute relatively more for health care than those in wealthy industrialized nations. In Germany, for example, where the average gross domestic product per capita is U.S. $32,860, and almost everyone has social health protection, 10% of all medical expenses nationwide are borne by households. In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, by contrast, where gross domestic product per capita is only $120, and where social health protection is scant, about 70% of the money spent on medical care is paid directly by households. This week, experts from some 40, this is from 2 weeks ago, but at any rate, the experts from some 40 countries meeting in Berlin at a conference convened by the Deutsche Gesellschaft für Technische Zusammenarbeit, GmbH, that is the GTC and a number of other German and international agencies, will lay out strategies countries and their partners can undertake to prevent such catastrophes. Social health protection is feasible, even in the developing world, but it has not got the attention that it deserves. Countries must begin now to craft well-organized schemes, and international donors will have to help. It takes years to put such a scheme into place, but if we start now by 2015, the target for the Millennium Development Goals, we could be well on the way to protecting people worldwide through equitable health financing, said Dr. Timothy Evans, the WHO Assistant Director General for Evidence and Information for Policy. So that's that article, and those issues can be found at who.int, and then you can just follow the links around to that. Again, one of the reasons why we might be optimistic about the outcomes of such a set of issues is that the antiretroviral therapy campaign, which got started when it became clear that many people in sub-Saharan Africa and other places could benefit from access to these very expensive anti-AIDS drugs in the north, an international campaign got started to see how we could get them to sub-Saharan Africa, where they had such minimal health access and where these drugs were far too expensive for the health systems of those countries. And through a combination of pressures on the pharmaceutical industry and knockoff drugs and international support funds that allowed for that paid for some of the costs for the developing world to have access to these drugs, we were able to provide at least some an increasing access to antiretroviral therapies. Now, the other question is, within the health systems of each of these countries, we have to build the capacity to distribute these drugs and make sure that they're taken appropriately. And in the future, when we have more enhancement type medicines, to make sure that those drugs are also universally accessible and delivered and tested in a safe way. Another editorial that caught my attention this last week was an editorial by Suzanne B. Haga and Huntington F. Willard that was published in The Washington Post. It's entitled Act Now to Prevent Genetic Discrimination. Cheers to IBM for its recent pledge not to use genetic information in its hiring practices or in deciding eligibility for health insurance coverage for its 300,000 employees. Yet the fact that IBM felt the need to take such action highlights the gap in federal legislation to adequately protect job candidates and employees from discrimination based on their personal genetic information. And will it be a bellwether for action on a national level? At least 20 bills have been introduced in Congress to prohibit genetic discrimination in the past 10 years. Only one has passed, providing limited protection against genetic discrimination for the group health insurance market. National legislation to prohibit genetic discrimination by employers and health insurers is way overdue. A prime example of the abuse of genetic information is a much-publicized $2.2 million settlement between Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway Company, and the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The railway tested or sought testing for 36 unsuspecting employees in an attempt to establish that injury claims were due to genetic disease and not to work-related activities. The science here was shaky, but the surreptitious misuse was clear-cut. The recent case involving former Chicago Bulls basketball player Eddie Curry and the team's request for DNA testing to diagnose a heart arrhythmia also highlights the interest in genetic information in making personal decisions. Testimony before a Federal Advisory Committee on Genetics, Health, and Society last year revealed that citizens were avoiding or hiding test results because they might lose their health insurance. Do we want women with a family history of breast cancer deciding not to get tested out of fear of discrimination? As more genetic tests are developed to help prevent disease or enable early detection, protections against the potential misuse of genetic information become ever more important. Employers may decide not to hire someone based on his or her genetic predisposition to diseases such as cancer or heart disease. Or an insurer may use premiums or decline coverage for individuals with a high risk of disease or disability based on genetic differences. The enactment of national legislation to protect all individuals from genetic discrimination will not just benefit a select few who are affected with a genetic disease. All of us have genetic miscues in our genomes that may one day lead to disease. Given all of the bills introduced over the last 10 years, what is the hang-up in passing this legislation? Most politicians support the legislation, as evidenced by the Senate vote on the most recent bill, 98-0, and the president has indicated his willingness to sign such legislation. Ironically, groups that represent employers have voiced concerns that this bill addresses a problem that doesn't exist and creates a new cause of action against employers. Therefore, the announcement by IBM comes both as a surprise and a welcome vote of confidence that businesses can survive without peering into the genomes of potential and current employees. In the absence of national protections, most states have passed legislation to prohibit or limit the use of genetic information for risk selection and risk classification for health insurance or employment purposes. However, the scope of protections varies by state. The only other employer known to offer protection from genetic discrimination is the federal government. In 2000, an executive order was signed by President Clinton, providing protection for 2.7 million federal employees. If the move by IBM instigates more employers to develop their own policies on the use of genetic information, this will result in a messy patchwork of company policies on top of inconsistent state laws. Regardless of how widespread genetic discrimination practices are, the fear of discrimination could cripple important genetic-related technologies before they are introduced. Fear drives policy, as evidenced by the anxiety surrounding genetically modified organisms in Europe. Without national protections, individuals may decline to participate in genetic research studies or may compromise their health by refusing testing of their genomes, thereby halting the field and promise of genetics. This is why IBM's action provides a model for Congress. Let's not squander the promises of genetics by failing to protect our citizens from discrimination. And that's an article that was in the Washington Post, an op-ed titled Act Now to Prevent Genetic Discrimination by Suzanne B. Haga and Huntington F. Willard. Next, I want to read just a section of an article that The Nation just published called Brave Neuro World, by Catherine Schultz, and you can find this article at thenation.com. It's in their January 9th, 2006 issue. This article is a wonderful little review of the emerging field of neuroethics and a stab at trying to discuss some of the progressive issues involved in the neuroethics field. Just a beginning, however, but I'll read some of it because I think it's wonderful that The Nation is actually talking about these things. This is the section Changing Brains. What if we had other powers? What if we could sleep less, rejuvenate our aging brains, rebound quickly from emotional trauma, improve our memories, regulate our moods, enhance our sexual response? Increasingly, we do have those powers, thanks to neurological interventions that range from psychopharmaceuticals to surgery to brain-machine interfaces. Currently, the most famous neurointerventions are SSRIs, the class of antidepressants that includes Prozac and Zoloft, and the anti-ADD medication Ritalin. But rivals are on the way. Consider, for instance, the drug Modafinil. Marketed in the United States as Provigil, Modafinil was developed to treat narcolepsy, but doctors and patients quickly realized that it enabled healthy people to stay awake far longer than normal, anecdotally for more than 3 days. Suddenly, narcoleptics had a lot of friends, Martha Ferris says with a laugh. Who can deny the allure of Modafinil? Not surgeons, one suspects, or long-haul truck drivers, or military personnel on multi-day missions, or, for that matter, journalists on deadline. Modafinil's intended use, like that of Prozac and Ritalin before it, is dwarfed by its non-medical potential. Because many therapies that help the sick can also benefit the healthy, this slippery slope from treatment to enhancement is a defining feature of the neurotechnology landscape. Thus, Alzheimer's drugs could improve normal memory, brain-machine interfaces for Lou Gehrig's disease patients could be adapted for Air Force pilots, and Modafinil could make workaholics of us all. Here, however, are some other salient details about Modafinil. There are no long-term studies of its effects, its mechanisms remain mysterious, and the role of sleep in regulating human health is largely unknown. These facts point to the most basic ethical concern about neurotechnologies, to wit, their safety. Arthur Kaplan, director of the University of Pennsylvania's Center for Bioethics, is a champion of neuroenhancement, but he acknowledges that technologically we can't even build a dam that doesn't break. Theoretically, safety issues could be handled by careful oversight, but history does not inspire optimism. To illustrate the point, in a debate with Kaplan, University of Minnesota bioethicist Carl Elliott cited three of the most common commercial successful medical enhancements of the recent years, SSRIs, hormone replacement therapy, and the diet drug Fen-Phen. All three were FDA approved and widely used before the public learned that the first are associated with suicide, the second with stroke, pulmonary embolisms, and breast cancer, and the third with heart disease and hypertension. Nor does history suggest that we will establish careful rules about when, why, and by whom neurotechnologies may be used. The most relevant forerunner may be reproductive technologies, and what's happened there is an absolute lack of oversight, Kaplan says. We've got no rules about counseling, about describing the risks of side effects. We have no agreement about who can use these services. The whole thing has been treated as a Wild West free market. That frontier free market mentality does not bode well for the poor. Given that we do not guarantee basic health care in this country or fully fund such low-tech equalizing efforts as Head Start, it's tough to imagine that we will ensure equal access to neuroenhancements for those who can't afford them. If enhancement becomes widespread, then the advantages it confers will only exacerbate existing disparities in education and employment. Kaplan is quick to point out that this injustice lies with society and not with science. Plenty of other technologies magnify disparities, from private schools to test prep courses. But neuroenhancement could make it not merely difficult, but biologically impossible for the poor to compete with the wealthy. It's worth asking, as Elliot does, whether we want to widen the gap by commodifying basic human traits and inviting the pharmaceutical industry to market them. Alongside questions about equitable access to neuroenhancers are equally grave concerns about the freedom not to use them. Already, some schools refuse to let difficult students attend class unless they take ADD medication. The Defense Department's Advanced Research Projects Agency funds research on modafinil because, quote, eliminating the need for sleep while maintaining a high level of both cognitive and physical performance will create a fundamental change in war fighting. Certain non-military employees could also be required or coerced into using neuroenhancements. Imagine, for instance, a drug that improves concentration among air traffic controllers. And then there is the thought experiment that I posed earlier. Should the law be allowed to mandate neurological interventions that decrease violence? Current case law suggests that the answer could be yes. Courts have ruled that if the state can administer the death penalty, it can also intervene in ways that stop short of death, chemical castration, for instance. As Farah points out, these uses of neurotechnologies threaten to violate a kind of freedom that to date is barely adumbrated within the law, the freedom to have our own personalities and control our own inner lives. When I asked Kaplan how we might protect people from pressure to alter their neurochemistry, he said, "I think you have to build niches for respecting those people, like how we've dealt with the Amish. They have opted away from common technologies, but we accommodate them, and they get to ride their little buggies around." Considering that the Amish make up less than 0.00003% of the population, and that cars are perhaps the most common and coveted technology in the country, I asked whether the analogy was apt, and he thought it was. I predict that many of these interventions will be like caffeine, which is an omnipresent enhancer. I'm not sure that anybody will have a giant implant in their head anytime soon, but as for the pill that lets you stay awake longer, or the this helps me focus pill, or the memory booster, I think it's crazy not to start anticipating that. Again, that's from a very nice essay by Catherine Schultz called Brave Neuro World at thenation.com, and you can read the full text of that essay there, which gets into some more of the issues involved in trying to articulate a progressive approach, whether progressives should make common cause with bioconservatives around these issues. And of course, you know my answer to that one, folks. I say no. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy high-tech and yet radically democratic future.